Welcome to this Throwback Thursday edition of the award-winning Best of the Left podcast, where we remember the past and choose to repeat it. Today's episode was originally published on February 5th, 2019. Our past couple of new episodes, numbers 1566 and 1567, have been exploring the snake oil ethics of greed and selfishness as laundered through the prisms of the sort of nihilism and libertarianism, also cloaked in a lot of misunderstanding. 1566 looked at the consumer side of capitalism, while 1567 looked at the macroeconomic side of corporations and the rise of neoliberalism. So today, I thought we would look in the other direction, away from the snake oil ethics of rationalized selfishness to the timeless moral framework to care for those around you as laid out in the Four Freedoms called for by FDR. Sources include Book TV, The Tom Hartman Program, A Progressive Faith Sermon from Dr. Roger Ray, Bill Moyers and Company, The Majority Report, and a mashup of Bernie Sanders and FDR.
I wrote The Fight for the Four Freedoms not only as a historian, I also wrote it as an historical advocate. There are those who think we make too much of the greatest generation and its greatest leader. I think we make too little of them. In short, to give you a sense of what this will be about, I think we are failing to remember what made FDR and the greatest generation truly great. And in failing to remember that, we are not just failing them, we are failing ourselves. And it's that argument, that story, that challenge, which I now offer to you. We need to remember. We need to remember what conservatives have never wanted us to remember and what liberals have all too often forgotten. We need to remember what we've been trying so hard to remember. Now, especially after more than 30 years of subordinating the public good to corporate priorities and private greed, of subjecting ourselves to widening inequalities and intensifying insecurities, of allowing our rights to be threatened, and of denying our own democratic impulses and yearnings. We need to remember who we are. We need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the men and women who rescued the United States from economic destruction in the Great Depression and defended it against fascism and imperialism in the Second World War. We need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the men and women who not only saved the nation from economic ruin and political oblivion, but also turned it into the strongest and most prosperous country on earth. And most of all, we need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the men and women who accomplished all of that in the face of fierce, conservative, reactionary, and corporate opposition. And despite their own faults and failings, by harnessing the powers of democratic government and making America freer, more equal, and more democratic than ever before. Now, when all that they fought for is under siege, and we too find ourselves confronting crises and forces that threaten the nation and all that it stands for, we need to remember that we are the children and grandchildren of the most progressive generation in American history. We are the children of the men and women who articulated, fought for, and endowed us with the promise of the Four Freedoms. On the afternoon of January 6, 1941, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt went up to Capitol Hill to deliver his annual message to Congress. Just weeks earlier, he had defeated Republican Wendell Willkie at the polls and won re-election to an unprecedented third term. But he now faced a bigger challenge, one even more daunting than those he confronted in his first and second terms. Still stalked by the Great Depression, the United States was also increasingly threatened by the Axis powers, Nazi Germany, fascist Italy, imperial Japan. And with war already raging east and west, Americans had yet to agree about how to respond to that threat. The president, however, did not falter. He not only proceeded to propose measures to address the emergency, he also gave dramatic new meaning, and I love reciting these words in this building, he gave dramatic new meaning to all men are created equal, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We, the people of the United States, a new birth of freedom and government of the people, by the people, for the people. Roosevelt knew about crises, but he knew as well what Americans could accomplish, even in the darkest of times. Born in 1882, he had grown up privileged, the son of Hudson River gentry. Yet long before becoming president, he had suffered serious defeats and setbacks. None more devastating than contracting polio in 1921 at the age of 39. The disease had left him permanently unable to stand up or walk without assistance. However, supported by his wife Eleanor and other family members and friends, he had risen above the paralysis to become the most dynamic political figure in the United States. Moreover, his experiences in the course of doing so had reaffirmed and deepened his already powerful faith and confidence in God, in himself, and in his fellow citizens. All of which had enabled him, in the face of the worst economic and social catastrophe in the nation's history, to say, "There is no question in my mind that it is time for the country to become fairly radical for a generation." To declare, "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself." To insist that democracy is not a static thing, it is an everlasting march. And to proudly proclaim, "This generation of Americans has a rendezvous with destiny." Propelled by the popular energies that his words and actions elicited, he determinedly launched the initiatives of relief, recovery, reconstruction, and reform known as the New Deal. Together, president and people severely tested each other, made real mistakes, regrettable compromises, and suffered serious defeats and sore disappointments. Nevertheless, challenging and pushing each other to live up to their finest ideals and aspirations, FDR and his fellow citizens advanced them further than either had expected or even imagined possible. Even as they confronted and dealt with harsh and concerted attacks from their powerful, conservative, and corporate antagonists, they not only rejected the sirens of authoritarianism, they also redeemed the nation's historic purpose and promise by initiating revolutionary changes in government and public life, and radically extending American freedom, equality, and democracy. By way of a great host of alphabet soup agencies and associations, from the SEC, CCC, and WPA, to the CIO, AYC, and NAACP, they subjected big business and banking to public account and regulation. They empowered the federal government to address the needs of working people and the poor, and established a Social Security system. They organized labor unions, consumer campaigns, and civil rights organizations. They fought for their rights, and they broadened the we in We the People. They built schools, libraries, parks, and playgrounds. They expanded the nation's public infrastructure. They improved the American environment. They cultivated the arts and refashioned popular culture. And though there was still much to be done, they imbued themselves with fresh democratic convictions, hopes, and aspirations. Standing before the American people and their assembled representatives that early January day in 1941, Roosevelt surely believed their rendezvous with destiny had come. Speaking without hesitation, he proceeded to expound upon the profound crisis and mortal dangers facing the United States, and to explain how the nation could not just confront them, but actually prevail in doing so. Rejecting isolationist arguments that America should simply hunker down behind great defensive walls, he rallied his fellow citizens around a dynamic image of America serving as the great arsenal of democracy. And dismissing conservatives' claims that the crisis required Americans to give up their hard-fought for advances, Roosevelt argued that an effective mobilization required them to not simply sustain their democratic achievements, but also extend and deepen them again. Finally, articulating America's grandest ideals and strivings anew, the president defined a cause and a generation. "In the future days which we seek to make secure," he said, "we look forward to a world founded upon four essential human freedoms. The first is freedom of speech and expression. The second is freedom of every person to worship God in his own way. The third is freedom from want. The fourth is freedom from fear." Isolationists denounced the president's call to turn the U.S. into the arsenal of democracy, and conservatives rejected his expansive democratic vision. But most Americans responded otherwise. While they may not have been able to recite those freedoms exactly, They backed the call to action, affirmed the promise pronounced, and in the wake of Japan's December 7, 1941 attack on Pearl Harbor, they made freedom of speech and expression, freedom of worship, freedom from want, freedom from fear, the nation's war aims.
Ted Cruz last night talked about freedom at some length and how freedom is going to bring our jobs back. Freedom is this magical thing, just like the free market. It's a piece of freedom. And here he is.
And if we stand together and choose freedom, our future will be brighter. Freedom will bring back jobs and raise wages. Freedom will lift people out of dependency to the dignity of work.
Right. Freedom will lift people out of dependency. In other words, when he says freedom, what he is saying to lift people out of dependency is do away with all programs that are involve the government taking tax money and giving it to people or doing things for people. Right. You want to lift people out of dependency? Hey, we don't need no stinking Social Security. We should privatize it and, you know, sell it off to the banksters. We don't need no stinking Medicaid and Medicare. Let people work for a living and earn their health insurance. That's, you know, I mean, this is this concept that has been peddled to us since the 60s, really a little before that, but it really started taking hold in the early 70s, actually. When Lewis Powell wrote his memo and all these think tanks emerged in the mid-70s that led right to the Buckley decision in 1976 that Lewis Powell wrote for the Supreme Court. And this idea that somehow freedom means freedom from, quote, government interference. And yet, without, quote, government interference, there would be no freedom. There would be no free market. There would be no marketplace, for example. If the government didn't manage our money supply, there'd be no marketplace. If the government didn't provide rules for business, what is fraud, what is not fraud, for example. Here's a court in which the rules against fraud can be enforced. Here's a rule in which contracts can be enforced. Or here's a court, excuse me, where contracts can be enforced. Here's a jail for people who don't want, you know, who don't play by the rules. I mean, it's somehow this Ayn Rand juvenile kind of high school fantasy that freedom means, well, in the case of the Ayn Rand novel, Atlas Shrugged, it was the daughter and son of a rich guy who inherited the railroad from their daddy and were very upset with the fact that the union, the railroad's union workers were concerned about their safety. How dare they? They're just those little people, right? So here you have, you know, a Republican Party platform that is calling for freedom in all its forms, right? You have freedom from Social Security, freedom from Medicare, freedom from any sort of health care, freedom from workplace safety rules, freedom from rules that would keep our air clean, freedom from rules that would keep our water clean so the companies can feel free to pollute all they want. Hey, you know, a few people die of cancer. What does it matter? No big deal. Freedom from the need to fund our public education system. I mean, literally, the Republican platform says, let's end our public schools. Rich people can afford to send their kids to school. What's the problem? It's freedom, you know? And it's like, let me share a somewhat different version of freedom, vision of freedom for you. Franklin Roosevelt famously said, quoting, this was from his, I think, 1932, or maybe it was his 36th speech, but, you know, accepting the nomination. And he said, an old English judge once said, a necessitous man is not a free man. And then he went on to talk about how if you are hungry, you're not free. If you are sick and can't get health care, you're not free. If you are homeless and cannot find a place to live, you're not free. If you are out of work and can't find a job because capitalism has failed and because the government will not be the employer of last resort, you're not free. If you're the victim of predation by big corporations or billionaires, you're not free. If you live in constant fear that the billionaires are going to take you out, you're not free. So we have here, like, basically two very different visions of freedom. You have the vision of freedom that has been held literally since the founding of our republic. The whole purpose of the Constitution was to create a government. It could establish rules for commerce. That's very specifically in there in the Commerce Clause. And rules for, you know, how society is basically functioning in a smooth and efficient way that protects us from government overreach, but at the same time protects us from corporate or billionaire overreach. I mean, Franklin Roosevelt said, you know, rule by organized money is as dangerous as rule by organized mob. And it's true. I mean, you know, the libertarians would refer to democracy as mob rule. That's the whole, you know, they're not, they would, an honest libertarian will come right out and tell you they don't believe in democracy, as has happened many times on this program. The little people, you know, they, you know, if they're not paying taxes, if they don't own property, if they're not, you know, and the subtext of that, of course, is if they're not wealthy and white, then they should have no say in how the government is run. That's their vision. That's the libertarian vision. And the Republican vision is very, very close to them.
I'm not an expert on American history, but I know enough to recognize that George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, James Madison, Ben Franklin, all had glaring blind spots, moral failings. But given the European soup of monarchy and class-tiered society that they emerged from, the experiment in democracy that they tried to launch was, and I'll defend this against all comers, it really was a moral triumph. But you don't go from a moral nightmare to perfection in one giant leap. You don't do it in a single generation, and apparently you don't do it in a century. Ensuring the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, of association, protections against unwarranted search and seizure, ex post facto laws, all that was huge. But by the time the world had fallen into the Second World War, it was evident that our 18th century Bill of Rights would never suffice to create the more perfect union that our founders envisioned. So in the midst of that global conflict, President Roosevelt envisioned coming out of that great war with the moral resolve to finish the job by creating a kind of economic independence that would actually make Americans free. Roosevelt proposed a second Bill of Rights with 8 points, and even though he proposed them more than four generations ago, really none of them have been entirely implemented. The last one about Social Security and Medicare certainly has been a huge gift, but we're still having to fight for all eight. The first of his points was the right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of the nation. That is to say, no one who wants to work should be unemployed. The New Deal exemplified a primitive model of this by creating public works jobs, and the result of that was not just some of the bridges and parks that we still enjoy here in Springfield today, but also certain art was created at that time. It is possible to employ everyone. Everyone who is willing and able to work should be able to have a paying job. No exceptions, because exceptions to that actually generates poverty. His second suggested amendment said that all Americans have a right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. Roosevelt was obviously advocating for full employment at a living wage, but there is that one more word here that I don't want for us to miss, and that is recreation. That's why I asked Sean to add the song Bread and Roses. In the early women's union movement, they weren't just asking for enough pay to be able to have bread on their table, but shouldn't they also be able to have roses now and then? Anyone who works, human beings don't exist simply to work. There's more. It always worries me when I hear of GE or some plant giving someone a perfect attendance award for 40 years. In 40 years, you never came up with anything better to do than make refrigerators. You couldn't call in sick now and then. And we are not cattle to be milked for our labor and then turned into leather coats and shoes and hamburgers. Compensation for labor should be enough to provide for some quality of life, not mere existence, but also happiness, some leisure and recreation. 100 years ago, women marched for bread and roses because they wanted to be both free and happy. The failure to take note of Roosevelt's Third and Fourth Amendments has resulted in a lethal transfer of wealth from the whole of the nation into the hands of the few. He mentioned the right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. We were saying in class this morning, they still tell the story about the Boston Tea Party being about a tax on tea. That had nothing to do with it at all. It had everything to do with this giant British corporation that was bringing tea to the country that was cheaper than the tea that American business owners were able to sell in their tea shops. And so it was the businessmen that got everyone together to go out and throw the cheap tea into the harbor. If we are really a free nation, then can we continue to allow the 1% to claim 80% of the earth and all of its resources for themselves and force the 99% to fight over the scraps? This unbounded economic system that can't seem to come up with a livable floor of income surely has to invent some kind of sane ceiling that makes the distribution of the world's wealth much more fair than anything we're ever going to get by just waiting for the largesse of the Walton or Bezos families or even the relatively generous Gates and Warren Buffett families. Somewhere between the very rich or even the obscenely rich and master of the universe, there has to be a sane place where we can say enough is enough already. Amen. There are more than enough resources in the world to satisfy the needs of the poor. But folks, there will never be enough to satisfy the greed of the rich. The society as a whole has a right, nay, has an obligation, to set sane boundaries to capitalism.
Why was the Four Freedom Speech so important?
I think the Four Freedom Speech is important in the most immediate sense of 1941, and that's really the call to war. Americans know what's coming. The call to war is we need to create an arsenal for democracy. We need to create a lend-lease program to secure Britain and its allies against Nazi Germany. And then he says, but don't misunderstand. We have to appreciate that if we're going to prepare ourselves for defense, that we don't give up what we've achieved these last 8 years. And he lays out new initiatives. What he knew and what he knew a generation knew was the only way
to defend, secure, and sustain American democracy as you constantly press to enhance it. You test the limits. We're the great experiment in democracy, and he knew that. He knew American history. So here he appears, and how does he close this speech? The four freedoms. And he actually says that these four freedoms are at the heart of American life. They're at the heart of this ongoing, perpetual, and peaceful revolution dating back to the time of the revolution.
I didn't realize until I read your book what the importance of the Victory Medal that every soldier, sailor, right. Marine,
airman
right. received in World War II. And tell me about that.
Well, this was a medal awarded at the end of the war to everyone who served in uniform. And this was a medal that on the front looks just like any other war medal. And when you flip it to the backside, it says,
freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom of speech, freedom of religion.
Yes. And it isn't that this was issued as a propaganda device. The war is over. This was issued because the Roosevelt administration knew that this is what Americans were fighting for. It was in any number of venues that you could see the evidence. Letters to newspapers by the wives who stayed home and went to work in the war factories and the men who went off to service. Americans couldn't always recite those four freedoms, but they knew exactly what they were fighting for.
I had to shake my head when I came to that moment in your book when you say that when Roosevelt delivering the speech got to freedom from want, no Republicans applauded, and Democrats didn't
applaud. I think that shook up the Republicans. Samuel Grafton, the then liberal New York Post columnist, said they sat in their hands. And then he got to freedom from fear, and that was when he said it. And I think a good number of Democrats, and you know who those were. They were the white supremacist Democrats.
Yes, because he was talking about freedom from persecution and discrimination.
Right, exactly.
And
exactly.
That's when the Dixiecrats would have sat on their hands,
yes,
Democrats.
Right. You know what's interesting, Bill, is if you read the exact wording of the speech and his idea of the four freedoms, Roosevelt states them in a way that might not have been so scary to the well-off. But Americans knew they were talking to he was talking to them. And when they heard freedom from want and freedom from fear, they had absolutely no doubt what he had in mind.
I remember you're quoting something that FDR said to a friend of his, I think in 1930. What was it?
He said to a friend, looking all around him with the devastation of the Great Depression, I think it's time that we make America fairly radical for a generation.
Fairly radical?
Fairly radical. Fairly radical.
Reminded me of Walt Whitman, be radical, be not too damn radical. What do you think he meant by that?
I think he meant that it was time to free ourselves of the conservative shackles of the 1920s, that it was time to enable working people to organize. It was time to provide old age pensions. I'm actually reading in my head from his campaign speeches. We needed to create public works projects. We needed to address the environment, soil erosion. Agriculture was fundamental to Franklin Roosevelt. Over and over again, out on the campaign trail that year, contrary to what historians seem to say, Roosevelt was saying, we need to do these things. That's what he meant by radical. But he didn't mean merely that he would do it, or the Democrats in Congress would do it. As we saw in the coming years, he meant, we will make America fairly radical for a generation. I have a theory, and here's my theory. I say that Reagan could never have become president if Democrats, progressives, and liberals had not already forgotten and forsaken the four freedoms. The only thing that enables conservatives to appeal to the vast majority of American working people is when that vast majority is disappointed and frustrated and angry.
You're right. We have been led to forget. And who has led us to forget?
So over and over again, we saw from right through the 30s, right through World War II, we saw corporate interests constantly trying to either directly suppress the ideas that are going to become the four freedoms, okay, by saying private enterprise, that's what makes America great, forgetting the struggle for freedoms, speech, expression. Freedom of worship, freedom from want, and freedom from fear that Roosevelt put into words. For example, Ronald Reagan. If you look closely at what Reagan does in the course of his presidency, he appears on July 3rd, 1987, at the Jefferson Memorial at an event sponsored by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he says that he wants to advance four freedoms. He says, you know, we Americans need to cultivate, we need to remember. He says we need to remember. And we need to teach our children history and make sure they remember. America is about freedom. And what does he say? Freedom of speech, freedom of worship, freedom of enterprise. He literally expunges freedom from want and freedom from fear.
So is this, have you written this as an agenda for the Democratic Party?
I don't know if the Democratic Party will attend to it. I want all of my fellow citizens to attend to this argument because I think Americans would respond if they heard it. Over and over again, what they hear from leaders is, yes, we can. And then at the moment of now, what are we going to do? They get left behind in favor of Washington, D.C. politics. Washington, D.C. politics.
Talk to me as a conservative who has real doubts about the efficacy of government, who really believes that there is a threat
right.
from unlimited government, and who thinks the New Deal didn't work the way you think it did.
Two things. First of all, let's imagine we're both conservatives, wealthy conservatives. And you know what I would say? I'd say, we don't really hate government. It's working perfectly for us. Why should we hate government? Out in public, why do they have this animosity towards government? Because what this generation did is they harnessed the powers of democratic government to make America freer, more equal, and more democratic. They harnessed the powers of democratic government. You know, they knew how to go about doing it because Roosevelt invited them to do so. And he brought to Washington these new deals and sent them out around the country. I mean, he opened up Washington to Catholics, Jews, African Americans, women. He made Washington connect with Americans, not simply to have a better political funnel sending out the messages, but to get those people out in the field going. Well, he would call his friend, Felix Frankfurter, up at Harvard University. He'd say, I need some new dealers, send them down. And all these young Catholic and Jewish lawyers would come in to see Frankfurter and say, I want to be a new dealer.
And it had been a WASP country up until
absolutely, absolutely. White Anglo-Saxon Protestant. And what was funny was these young Catholic and Jewish lawyers, Frankfurter would say to them, go to Wall Street for 2 years. Learn about them so you can control them. This is great, right? And they became known as the hot dogs.
Did you write this book to make people fighting mad? Because they're going to be fighting mad on either side of the political spectrum when they read it.
Yes, absolutely. I want them to be fighting mad. I want them to be fighting mad like Roosevelt was. I want them to say, we need to make America fairly radical for a generation. What we need to do is we need to go back and remember the kinds of things that Roosevelt knew, that there's deep in every American this desire to redeem the meaning of America. And he knew that there are ways of getting people to act, because if you can speak to them as an American, remind them of who they are, invite them to offer their labors, invite them to organize in the 1930s. I mean, organizers went out and said, you've got to organize. The president wants you in a union. It worked. Millions joined. And by the way, living standards rose. Worker security improved. We get Social Security. I mean, look what we've done. And look what we're allowing to happen now. This cannot be the America that I imagined and most of my fellow Americans imagine. But they have forgotten not the four freedoms as ideals. They have forgotten what it takes to realize them, that we must defend, sustain, and secure democracy by enhancing it. That's what Roosevelt knew. That's what Jefferson knew. And no one seems to remember that today. That's what we have to remind people of.
It's wanted to quickly let you know I found a good argument when I was arguing with libertarians that it might help you on your show.
Okay, let's hear it.
A lot of people like this. You know, libertarians are definitely for freedom. I think the main point of contention for me, anyway, is that when you have very little money, you have freedom in name only because you're switching costs. Like, let's say you have a job and a family to support.
Absolutely.
Your switching costs, switching careers are very high. You can't afford it. And so basically your freedom, the way to get people to be free is to give them at least some basic income, some kind of guaranteed income, so that they are actually free to go and educate themselves and choose their job.
I have made this argument with libertarians many times in the past. Their definition of freedom, for some reason, does not include the freedom to pursue a career that you want to pursue. You may be inhibited. Your freedom is inhibited by student loans. Your freedom to get an education is a function sometimes of money. Your freedom to pursue the work you want is sometimes a function. You can't get health insurance. And they don't accept that level of freedom. They have no problem with economic coercion by more powerful economic factors. They have no problem with a lack of freedom that comes from requirements of basic subsistence living. That's not an issue. That's not the freedom they're talking about.
So how do they explain? How do they think it's a free market if many of the participants are not really free to choose what they want to do?
You're always free to choose. You can choose to starve if you want. You can choose to die as opposed to working if you want, because you can't. That's always a choice. The
dying
only thing
on
they
the
recognize
table, right?
is as coercive for some reason is if you're put into a physical cell. That's the only coercion that they believe exists. There is no other form of coercion, according to libertarians. Only the state, in its capacity to put you in jail, that's the only form of coercion that can exist in their worldview, because many of them have not had to feel the impact of having a family and desperately needing health insurance for them. Or they're old enough where they realize, hey, I need health insurance for me to survive. They don't recognize coercion in any form other than the capacity to be put in jail by the federal government more often than not. That's just their bailiwick. I don't know what to tell you, Greg.
Now, Roosevelt's fifth tenet is the right of every family to a decent home. Now, our little church building was first constructed here in the middle of a lower middle class neighborhood with very modest homes all around us. But in the past decade that we've owned this building, the area just outside of town has become populated with gated communities protecting private homes that look to me to be the size of small hotels. And have evidently nearly as many rooms and bathrooms as a small hotel. And most of them, when I talk to people that know who live in these neighborhoods, there's not more than two people living in each one of those houses. I'm not sure what they're compensating for if two people need a three-story home with eight bedrooms and eight bathrooms. On the one hand, you might say that such competition in a social edifice complex is none of our business. But is it none of our business when there are nearly 1,000 people in this city living under bridges and in drainage culverts and sewer catch basins? Can a just society let Fred and Susie sleep with their little Sarah and Billy in a car on Commercial Street while Brett and Brittany have an 8,000 square foot home in Springfield and a 3,000 square foot cabin on the lake and a 4-bedroom ski lodge in Aspen? At some point, you have to see there's a connection between Brett and Brittany having too many houses and Fred and Susie not having a house. This is not complicated. Excess at one end of the scale creates deficits at the other end of the scale. The very wealthy will always have nicer digs than the poor. As Paul said, I've been rich and I've been poor. What Paul didn't say is rich is better. The rich will always have a nicer place to live. But can't we also say that there has to be a rational floor beneath which no one should fall? Shouldn't everyone have a safe and decent shelter in which they can cook and sleep and bathe? I wouldn't care if Brett had an elevator for his cars in his garage if I didn't see Fred being turned away at cross lines because did you know we can't give groceries to someone that doesn't have a refrigerator and a stove? Did you know that? You can be so poor that even a poverty program is not allowed to help you. Did you know that there are people with such little income that even Habitat for Humanity cannot give them a house? I'm just making the modest proposal that Brett can have his 18-seat home theater when Fred gets a refrigerator and a flushing toilet. That's not too much to ask.
Today, certain economic proofs have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed. Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job.
I've introduced a $1 trillion piece of legislation that would go a long way to rebuild our crumbling roads, bridges, airports, water systems, and by the way, support the creation of 13 million decent paying jobs.
The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation.
The $7.25 minimum wage is a starvation wage. We need to raise it over a period of years to $15 an hour. Nobody working 40 hours a week in this country should live in poverty.
The right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom, freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad.
The six largest financial institutions have assets of almost 60% of our GDP. It's time to break up the large Wall Street banks.
We need to fundamentally transform our trade policies. They are not working. Corporate America is going to have to start investing in the United States, not in China.
The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health.
The United States remains the only major country on earth without a national health care program, and yet we spend almost twice as much per capita. It is time for America to guarantee health care to every man, woman, and child as a right of citizenship.
The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment.
Some of my colleagues in Congress are working day and night to try to cut Social Security, cut Medicare, cut Medicaid. Needless to say, I strongly disagree.
The right to a good education.
Millions of our young people are graduating school deeply in debt, and many others cannot afford to go to college. Anyone who has the ability and desire should be able to get a college education, regardless of the income of their family.
All of these rights spell security. We must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to new goals of human happiness and well-being.
We are at a crucial moment in American history, and it is imperative that we organize, that we educate, that we bring people together to create an America that works for all of us.
For unless there is security here at home, there cannot be lasting peace in the world.
When we talk about the the success, I should say, of the pushback by corporate powers, by the free marketeers.
Right.
We usually date that starting in the early 70s, but it was happening through the 40s, obviously, the 50s.
Yeah.
From the moment that the New Deal was passed, the Republican platform was calling it socialism, communism,
right,
and saying it was problematic. Yeah. So they, in some respects, I mean, Reagan, I want to jump ahead a little bit because we're
yeah,
heading towards the time, but,
yeah, Reagan, of course, was a member of that Greatest Generation. And he had been an avid supporter of Roosevelt and an avid supporter of Truman. But in the course of the 1950s, he moved to the right. And he became, of course, a spokesperson, a leading spokesperson of the right and for big business against the legacy of the New Deal, attacking Social Security, attacking Tennessee Valley Authority, you know, the big projects down south. I mean,
he was anti-union of films, I guess, at the time.
Right, even as he himself headed up the Screen Actors Guild.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about bizarre, right? So when he wins the presidency, when he runs for the presidency in the 1970s, he is himself trying to temper his language, because he knows Americans will not vote against someone who is attacking Roosevelt. So basically, he redirects his attack a bit towards the Great Society of Lyndon Johnson. And then, however, when he's in office, it's fascinating, he tries to turn the language, the rhetoric, the vision of Roosevelt upside down. So he wants to create, he says in 1987, he gives this speech at the Jefferson Memorial on July 3rd, 1987, sponsored by the Chamber of Commerce, not surprisingly, where he's going to create an economic bill of rights. And in this economic bill of rights, instead of guaranteeing Americans their rights and guaranteeing Americans their needs, Roosevelt said, necessitous men are not free men. What Reagan does is he turns it upside down and he talks about guaranteeing profits, lowering taxes. I mean, it's literally turning Roosevelt's idea of the Four Freedoms and Economic Bill of Rights inside out. I mean, that's the kind of thing that takes place. And by the way, even today, conservatives directly attack FDR's Four Freedoms. Jim DeMint, who was the U.S. Senator from South Carolina and now the head of the Heritage Foundation,
right,
he has written books in which he makes it a point of attacking freedom from one head on. Ron Paul, right, the father of Rand Paul, who was for many years in Congress, he actually has a chapter in one of his recent books which denigrates craps all over the idea of the Four Freedoms. I mean, conservatives to this day have in their heads that they're going to undo the New Deal, and you and I both know that this is a class war from above that's been going on for 40 years.
I mean, really, in terms of the New Deal, that it's been going on for 80 now, I guess. I mean, it's interesting too, because the pushback started relatively early when the I think it was the Chamber of Commerce came up with a fifth freedom, right? Which was
private enterprise, right?
Yes. I mean,
that's
this
right.
is fascinating to me when, you know, the idea that Reagan would attempt, I mean, because, I mean, this is a little bit far afield, but the idea that Reagan would attempt to address the idea of those four freedoms and the Economic Bill of Rights, supplant them with it was freedom to work, freedom to enjoy the fruits of one's labor. In other words, freedom to spend a lot of money,
right?
And freedom to work, of course, means I don't have to join a union. The freedom to own and control one's property. In other words, you can't tell me I have to serve black people. The freedom to participate in a free market, which of course again means child labor laws, minimum wage,
yeah,
whatever
right.
you want to talk about are all wrong. The idea, I mean, the reason why I'm hitting on this so importantly is to communicate just how important it is perceived by political leaders to undo even those things that were aspirational and are rhetorical in many respects.
Yeah. Right.
Because that's where it launches from.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really does. And by the way, I mean, Reagan was an artist at doing just that kind of thing. My previous book to the Four Freedoms book was about Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And I actually open with Reagan's speech in 1980 to the Republican National Convention accepting the nomination. And what's fascinating there is he quotes three great Americans: Abraham Lincoln, Thomas Paine, and Franklin Roosevelt. And he shocked the Republican delegates because the one Republican they didn't want to know anymore was Abraham Lincoln. The one radical from the Revolution they would have nothing to do with for 200 years, they hated his guts, was Thomas Paine. And you know how much they despised Roosevelt. So what Reagan does is he literally grabs hold of these three figures because he knows he's got the nomination. He wants to talk to the American people now. And he knows that every American loves Lincoln, has a firm affection for Thomas Paine, and will never give up their affection for Franklin Roosevelt. And he's beginning to figure out a way to turn them inside, upside down and inside out.
The right to a good education. Long ago, our nation realized that we could not survive as a viable democracy without an educated population. But technology, the marketplace, and the global network of the economy has changed in such a way that a college education is as necessary to a successful career today as a high school education was a generation ago. What nations from Europe to South America have realized that if they want to be an economically successful country in the future, that they have to make university education tuition free, and they're doing it right now. Germany realized this. Go ahead. Enjoy yourselves. Germany realized this. So did Denmark, Finland, Venezuela. People... Slovenia doesn't charge tuition at their universities. But in the United States, we're doing the exact opposite. We're doing what our closest rivals and worst enemies would want us to do. If the Soviet Union could ask us to do anything to guarantee that their star will rise and ours will fall, if China wants us to do anything, it's to make tuition higher and make it more difficult for a larger group of people in the United States to receive a higher education. Because that will make sure that if we don't correct this, we will become the nation that is exporting labor to go shine the shoes of the French and pick coffee beans in Venezuela. That wall between the United States and Mexico may become Mexico's best defense against American illegal agricultural workers pouring over their border, which is the only circumstance under which Mexico will pay for the wall. That was clever. That was more of a laugh line than an applause line. Help me edit this, will you? Our apparently crazy socialist political friend, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, also said that we should also have the right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. For all of Sarah Palin's warnings about death panels and Ben Carson's insistence that Obamacare is worse than slavery, Our American healthcare delivery system that discriminates between the rich and the poor, between the insured and the uninsured, to a degree that Franklin Roosevelt, even confined to his wheelchair when he wrote this, he could have never imagined how screwed up our healthcare delivery system could become. I'm 62 years old, and I have never taken a sick day in my entire adult life, and yet my health care premium is more than my house payment. So that once a year, a very pretty young doctor with a diamond stud in her nostril can look at me and say, you know, you really ought to lose weight. I'm paying $14,000 a year for that advice. Millions of Americans die prematurely because they either have no insurance or they cannot begin to afford the high deductibles on the insurance they do have. Our system of rationing health care only to the wealthy and the well-insured actually costs more than giving adequate health care to everyone. And in light of that simple fact, Americans cannot escape being labeled as being moral monsters in the modern world. We could give health care to everyone and save money by doing it. We just don't want to. And the choice not to do so sends hundreds of thousands to their graves prematurely. And our politicians, with rare exception, never mention this fact. And you know what hurts me even more? Pulpits are silent on this fact. I don't have repeatable words strong enough to describe the contempt that I have for pastors that never talk about this topic. Amen. We've been trying to correct this situation for over a century. Every other industrialized nation in the world has done it. Countries whose church attendance is not a tenth of what it is in America. So when you hear me say that mainstream religion is more of a problem than it is a solution, I want you to understand I'm talking about hundreds of thousands of unnecessary deaths every year because our churches have not led our country in a revolution of conscience that would make us move to universal health care. Finally, Roosevelt's Second Bill of Rights asserts that we all have the right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. Now, this is the one of Roosevelt's 8 declared rights that he actually meaningfully addressed through the Social Security and Medicare systems. It's far from perfect, but it has been adulterated in a way to ensure that it will eventually collapse actuarially. Even still, such mathematical geniuses as George W. Bush and Marco Rubio have wanted to privatize it so that the hard-earned retirement money paid into by working people everywhere can then be stolen in fees for hedge fund managers. The very elite have an inexplicable and indefensible belief that they somehow are the rightful owners of the assets of the poor and the middle class. And the only thing that will keep them from taking those assets is if churches and labor unions and low-wage workers and voters will wake up and have a conscience, will wake up and defend themselves from being exploited by the powerful. Thank you. As you may have noticed, I have a real fondness for finding historical examples of people who promoted progressive ideas from long ago. Using Roosevelt's proposed Second Bill of Rights was actually a suggestion from one of our YouTube listeners. But I wrote this sermon sitting at the Gethsemane Monastery in the refectory, and Brother Luke sent his greetings to you. I noticed sitting right next to my coffee cup there in the refectory was a quote from the 4th century Turkish saint, Saint John Chrysostom, who said, "Not to enable the poor to share in our goods is to steal from them and deprive them of life." Whether it was Roosevelt in the last century, Saint Chrysostom in the 4th century, Jesus in the 1st century, or Buddha in the 4th century BCE, there has always been a clear and simple path towards a sincere spirituality and a healthy civilization, and that is to make sure that none of our brothers and sisters fall through the cracks of an economic system that always seems poised to steal their humanity from them, if not their very lives. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. You know that we have not become that more perfect union that still lies within our grasp, and it is your life assignment to bring it into existence.
Thanks for listening to another throwback episode plucked from the archives to give you context for today. For more like this, check the feed, as this is a weekly feature of the show that's in addition to all of our new episodes. As always, keep the comments coming in. You can leave a voicemail or text at 202-999-3991 or email me to j@bestofleft.com. These episodes are remastered and produced by Dion Clark, Aaron Clayton, and myself. We also produce funny and informative bonus episodes along with Amanda Hoffman, as thanks to those who support the show by becoming a member or purchasing gift memberships to the show. If you get value out of the show, we'd appreciate your support at bestofleft.com/support, through our Patreon page, or from right inside the Apple Podcasts app. And if you want to continue the discussion, join our Discord community. There's a link to join in the show notes. So, coming to you from far outside the conventional wisdom of Washington, D.C., my name is Jay, and this has been the Best of the Left podcast, with new episodes coming to you twice weekly, thanks entirely to the members and donors to the show from bestofleft.com.